Good morning, Connecticut, and to our friends across the Sound. It's John Voquette, Director of Public Affairs for Connoisseur Media. Thanks for tuning into our award-winning public affairs program, For the People, bringing you even more information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. Well, this morning we're going to open replaying the first of a two-part series we did in early July, where we created a radio guidebook to your Social Security Administration. Then we're going to turn our attention to 1214, tomorrow's third anniversary of the Sandy Hook tragedy. We're going to replay a segment we did with Dr. Jeremy Richman, who, along with his wife Jennifer Hensel, is celebrating and memorializing their daughter, Aviel, with the groundbreaking Aviel Foundation and its research and programs addressing brain health and behavior. Then we'll wrap up with a more recent chat with Grammy-nominated saxophonist and arranger Jimmy Green and his wife, Nelma Marquez Green, who just hosted a sold-out Anna Grace Foundation symposium on community healing at Western Connecticut State University in memory of their daughter, Anna Grace, who was also among the 20 children lost at Sandy Hook. We'll be back with these segments and more on the award-winning For the People with me, John Voquette, right after this news. Coming up on Saturday, February 27th, the American Association of University Women's Connecticut chapter is hosting its third annual Tech Savvy Conference from 8 to 4 at Trinity College in Hartford. This day-long event is designed to show girls firsthand how science, technology, engineering, and math, STEM science fields, can lead to exciting and very rewarding careers. As part of AAUW's National Tech Savvy Pilot Program, the conference is welcoming more than 200 sixth to ninth grade girls and their parents and teachers. Registration for Tech Savvy opens in January, and you can get registered at aauw-ct.net. Those interested in becoming presenters for the conference can also contact Dr. Catherine Arrico, Assistant Professor of Civil and Biomedical Engineering at the University of Hartford, by email at Arrico, A-R-I-C-O, at hartford.edu. All right. Well, we're going to open this happy new fiscal year program on the award-winning For the People, talking about Social Security. As we said in our introduction, it's probably something that you either think about a lot or don't think about at all. And there is so much to the Social Security Administration and the Social Security programs than just retirement related. And so we're going to find out a bunch of information on a two-part sort of radio handbook on Social Security with our new friend, Robert Rodriguez. He is a Metropolitan Public Affairs Specialist with the Boston Region Area 1 of the Social Security Administration. His base is actually right here in Connecticut.
Yes, we basically cover the six New England states, but my team basically covers most of Connecticut and parts of Rhode Island.
Excellent. So you've got an anniversary, big anniversary coming up in August. I'm glad we could get ahead of that. The Social Security Administration is showing its age in some respects, but in a lot of ways that we're going to be talking about over the next two segments, you're very cutting edge. Social Security is very cutting edge, very 21st century oriented as well. But let's go back in time and celebrate this 80th anniversary that's coming up in August.
Well, yes, fantastic, John. Thank you. First of all, just thank you for the opportunity. Honestly, as you mentioned earlier, some people think about Social Security and sometimes they don't. But my pitch to everyone who's listening today is basically to, visit our website. Anything we're going to talk about today, I'm basically just hitting the tip of the iceberg, if you will. All of our information, basically covering everything from A to Z, can be found on our website at www.socialsecurity.gov. And yes, in next month, on August the 14th, Social Security is going to be celebrating its 80th birthday. I think it's a good testament to the strength of the program. It's been around a very long time. We've assisted, millions and millions of individuals. And, we continue to be there ever since from the program's inception. It's pretty much been there. And when President Roosevelt signed the act back on August the 14th of 35, he promised that the law would protect the average citizen and his family against the loss of a job and against, poverty-ridden old age. Mm. And, you know, today we do continue to provide that financial security for, you know, our most vulnerable citizens and all the agency employees. We look to give every single person that comes across our path world-class service, either online, on the phone, and, you know, in our network of field offices across the country.
Mm-hmm. And in Connecticut, too, it's not just about going to a website. A lot of folks in your service demographic like the face-to-face, and they like the phone call. They like to have the live voice on the other end versus just clicks and a mouse and a screen, even though I guess you now have chat capabilities and a lot of handicap services available electronically. Let's start with the in-person Social Security experience. Tell us where folks might go if they need to or want to get resources from the Social Security Administration in person here in Connecticut.
No problem. We have 15 field offices here in the state of Connecticut. And just to give you a quick statistical background, if I could very quickly, we currently have in-state right now 717,792 individuals that are receiving some sort of benefit from Social Security. And monthly, on a monthly basis, you're looking at about, it's approximately about $981 million a month that gets deposited here, you know, in the state of Connecticut. You know, and we're a relatively small state, if you will, but if you make comparisons to Texas, California, Ohio, you can see the importance. Anybody who does visit a local Social Security field office, we want to let individuals know that the first line of business, if they can possibly do this, is to go online. And secondly, a person can conduct business with us over the phone. We kind of recognize that some people may be housebound, and we can conduct all their business over the phone. We would call you on a specific day and time, and it would be the same as if you were in the office. At the same time, you know, I recognize and we recognize that some people would like to have that face-to-face contact, and we're okay with that.
Yeah, or they're just uncomfortable with the electronic.
That's true.
Yeah, and they certainly don't have to be in the senior population, as you probably know. There's folks of many age ranges that might need Social Security Administration services who might just want to do it in person.
John, it's so across the board. I mean, we, you know, anybody from a newborn, if you will, and parents giving us a call all the way up to somebody who's, you know, over 100. But I do want to make individuals aware just of one of the changes we did have is just with the office hours. We are open Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, and Friday from 9 until 4 o'clock. That represents a change that we had. We were initially open just until 3. Mm-hmm. Now we have an extra hour of service. And every Wednesday from here until the end of the year, our offices are open at 9 a.m., and they close the doors at 12 noon. At 12 noon, the employees begin to work on backlogs and other critical components and factors that we just have to just, you know, basically do some catching up with.
Great. And you then mentioned also the value of the 800 number. Once again, if folks want to interact with a live voice on the phone eventually and not just with the computer.
Right. The advantage of the 800 number is that it's open Monday through Friday from 7 in the morning to 7 at night. So if a person calls us first thing between 7 and 9, your chances are pretty good. If you begin to call us between 9 and, say, you know, regular hours of 4 o'clock, then it may be a little bit heavier. You may have to wait. And then on the backside, say from 4 down, again, you know, your chances are going to be a lot better. We have teleservice centers that operators that pick up the phone across the country. So when the East Coast is shutting down, the other time zones are picking up.
Very good.
And I think it's a good advantage. I mean, we can answer a lot of questions via the 800 number as well.
Great. And finally, for this introductory segment of our two-part radio handbook on Social Security, celebrating 80 years, but very much a cutting-edge agency here in Connecticut and across the country, let's talk a little bit about the online services in the last couple minutes that we have with you this week, and then we'll be returning with you again next week to focus on some of the specific programs and services of Social Security Administration. So tell us about this very, very robust website that you folks have.
We appreciate that. Our website has won awards. And literally, John, the website as I mentioned earlier, does have everything from A to Z. But what I want to have individuals do is to really basically point out, once you visit the website on the page, we have what's called the My Social Security, which is the latest and the most greatest thing that we have currently going right now. It's for a campaign that we have. We're asking people to visit the website, to visit My Social Security. There's a specific link that says that. This allows you to basically create your own My Social Security account where you can then now look at your record and see the years that you worked, how much you're going to get from Social Security for retirement or for disability benefits, or should you pass away, how much your survivors would get. But we also have such a wide array of online services. We have you can apply for disability benefits. You can apply for spousal benefits. We have what's called a retirement estimator. This allows you the opportunity to go into the website, and you're able to get figures in terms of how much you would get at age 62 or how much you would get at age 63. At the same time, we have other items of interest, frequently asked questions, which is updated. You can check your application status. It has information about Social Security numbers. It has what's called a benefits planner. Any publication that Social Security has, a person is able to get that publication and download it. You can get the forms that we utilize. It gives you an update on news, talks about the 80th anniversary, and then about contacting us.
Right.
There is a little link that talks about contacting us. You can get any office, be it here or say if it's Santa Fe, New Mexico, or somewhere in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
Again, it really is, as you mentioned earlier, it's cutting edge. The agency's made a big focus on, you know, providing this option to individuals because we know, as we say, you know, times are changing and more people are computer savvy, and yep, this is how they want to conduct business with us.
Great. Rob Rodriguez is the Metropolitan Public Affairs Specialist with the Boston Region Area, one of the Social Security Administration, serving much of Connecticut and Rhode Island and parts of Massachusetts. We are going to come back at the same time next week with the second half of our interview with Mr. Rodriguez, where we're going to drill in a little bit deeper on some of the Social Security programs, retirement, Medicare, disability, survivors benefits, and the SSI. The Supplemental Security Income Program. We're also going to talk a little bit more about how they're working to educate folks about getting a statement for retirement planning purposes and the Someday campaign and continuing to ready for the 80th anniversary celebration of Social Security that happens in August. We'll be back next week at the beginning of our program with Robert Rodriguez. But in the meantime, Robert, thank you for being with us on this 4th of July weekend, and we'll talk to you again next week. I'm joined now by Dr. Jeremy Richman. He and his wife, Dr. Jennifer Hensel, have founded the Aviel Foundation in memory of Aviel Richman, one of the victims of the 1214 tragedy in Sandy Hook. The Aviel Foundation is working on preventing violence by fostering brain health research, education, and policy, as well as community development, engagement, and responsibility. We're here today to talk about that, along with a very special guest who you may hear, Imogen, their brand new little baby. So, Dr. Richman, welcome to the program. Imogen, welcome to your radio debut.
Thanks so much, John.
So,
pleasure to be here.
Yeah, it's great to hear your voice today, especially. Let's talk a little bit about the process of finding the direction that the Aviel Foundation is now getting great traction on. Let's talk about putting this effort together and what was the impetus to take the direction of the foundation to the avenue of science.
Well, that's a good question. You know, after on 12/14 of 2012, we lost our only daughter at that time, Aviel, and that was, you know, obviously quite devastating. And we were literally on the floor, and just driven to do something. We couldn't suffer without with the thought of not doing anything to prevent another tragedy like this from happening again. And when you look around at how the country reacts to these acts of mass violence that are very sensationalized, it kind of comes down to sort of the trifecta that we're used to seeing now in reaction to the violence, which is, you know, the three legs of the trifecta are, it's all about guns, it's all about school safety, or it's all about mental illness. And there's no question that I think we as a society and a culture have to come together and understand what it means to be responsible gun owners, and what the right to own guns comes with, what responsibilities that comes with. I think we really need to introspect that and think about that. When it comes to school safety, I think we have to recognize that while the sensationalized acts of mass violence have occurred sometimes in schools, that violence typically does not happen in our schools, and that what we really need to focus on is why we're not safe in our communities. You know, these acts happen in our places of worship and in movie theaters and on street corners every day. And we need to figure what are we willing to do and what are we doing wrong that we aren't safe in our community. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to mental illness, we never really go the distance. We don't get anywhere, in fact. And this is, there's lots of reasons for that. But being scientists that we are, we wanted to play to our strengths. And so this is the avenue that we took, starting on basically the 17th of December of 2012, we decided that we would start a foundation committed to supporting research into understanding and preventing violence and building compassion. And that became the IVL Foundation. And we think that the reason that there's so little known about the brain, in fact, the brain science is our most unexplored of all of our sciences. And there's a lot of reasons for that. The brain is just another organ, like the liver, the lungs, the heart, the kidney. It can be healthy and unhealthy, but unlike those organs, it's really hard to study the brain. It's housed inside of our skull. It's not WYSIWYG. What you see is what you get. You can't look at a brain and say, oh, clearly it does this. And it's hard to study. It's very expensive to study. But we really want to support that research, particularly as it pertains to behaviors that are violent, or on the other side of that, compassionate. And so that's the mission of the foundation, to fund that research. On the other side of the foundation, we also believe that research in a vacuum by itself is irresponsible. You have to give it to people so that they can use it. And not in an elitist sort of scientific way. We have to give it to the everyday citizen, from students to parents to teachers to healthcare providers to law enforcement, in a way that everybody can understand it, digest it, and use it as a tool. So the other half of our mission is community engagement and education when it comes to brain health.
Mm-hmm. In the short turnaround, can you talk a little bit about the different dynamics that you're hearing from those three key demographics, if you will, the teachers, the law enforcement, and educators and things? If you could cite a particular aha moment or a point of convergence either among those groups or some overlap, is there some common denominator that everyone really kind of latently realizes but sort of needed you to be the catalyst to sort of light the fuse?
When we started traveling around the country trying to talking to scientists, talking to politicians up on the Hill in D.C., when we were talking to friends across the country, we realized that you got healthcare providers, law enforcement, and parents, essentially these three communities. We realized that there was no cell involved. People really resonated with this. And that there's a huge unmet need. But I think the aha moment that you're asking about was really, I have to credit Jen for this, because she's a scientist and speaks the language of science very fluently. But what's an advantage is that while I'm trained in neuroscience, she's not. She's trained in infectious diseases and now moving into oncology and cancer research.
Mm-hmm.
So the advantage being that she's not constrained by the dogma, the assumptions that come along with you know, being trained in a particular field. And when we were talking about mental illness, she just got gets very uncomfortable. She says, "You know, everything mental is so invisible. We don't diagnose diseases of the brain based on any pathologies. They're all, from what you know you're telling me, Jeremy, is that they're all diagnosed based on symptoms and syndromes." And I said, "That's right." And she said, "Well, that's why people have a problem with it. It's totally invisible, and we can't anybody hope."
No dipstick there to check that level, right?
Right, that's exactly right. Perfect analogy. And so she said, "Well, why don't we just call it what it is? It's a brain illness, and it's chemistry and not character that's mm-hmm. wrong." And so nobody's going to have a problem with that. If you go to the doctor and they say, "Oh, you know, little Johnny, he's right in the middle of the growth curves. He's sleeping better. Good job getting him to eat healthier." And you're right. There's a little bit. What we found was there's a little too much dopamine in his right cingulate cortex, which is doctor science speak for that explains why he has a little bit of impulse control problems at school. Here's what we recommend doing. We'll go through this therapy over the next couple of weeks and see how he progresses. A parent's not going to have, you know, there's no character judgment. They're not doing anything wrong. And there's something to do. There's something to fix. As opposed to the way it is now, little Johnny's got ADHD. It's a label, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy, and it's very scary, and there's not much that you're gonna give the parent besides something they already knew.
Yeah, and not only it stigmatizes the individual within their own head,
right.
And it stigmatizes them in virtually any community to which that diagnosis is revealed, let's face it.
Right, that's exactly right, John. And so what we feel that the liberating aha moment for the target audience is that we don't have to break down the barriers of stigma, so to speak, because they just don't exist in the brain health area.
Mm.
What we need to do is to fill in the tools so that we can actually give people diagnoses, give people working interventions and healthy therapies, bridging the biochemical sciences and the behavioral sciences in such a way that we can actually give them something to do to intervene and to build compassion and prevent violent and aggressive behaviors.
Okay. Folks, if you just joined us, we are having a very stimulating conversation with Dr. Jeremy Richman. He, along with his wife, Dr. Jennifer Hensel, lost their daughter, Aviel, on 12/14 in the tragic Sandy Hook shootings. Out of it has come the Aviel Foundation, which we're talking about today. If you'd like to learn more about this breakthrough work that's going on right now with the folks engaged with the Aviel Foundation, it's avielfoundation.org, AVIELLE foundation.org. Also, if you're hearing a little bit of noise in the background, that is the radio debut of Imogen Richman, the brand new addition to the Richman Hensel household. We're going to be back in about a couple of minutes and talk a little bit more about the other component of the Aviel Foundation's work, and that is community-based initiatives. Jeremy, stick with us. Folks, stick with us. We'll be right back. Do you love Connecticut? If you do, there are hundreds of nonprofit agencies, community groups, and grassroots causes that would love to have your support. You can learn about many of them through Love CT. Just go to our radio station website, hit the event guide tab, and click on to Love CT to help the many causes supported by Connoisseur Media. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. We'll be back to the award-winning For the People right after this news. Cycle for Survival is the national movement to beat rare cancers with a special fundraising event taking place February 21st in Greenwich. Every dollar raised locally and nationally goes to clinical trials and research studies led by Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, which owns and operates Cycle for Survival. Together with the movement's founding partner, Equinox, more than $55 million has been raised since 2007. The fun indoor team cycling events are a meaningful way to fight back against cancer. Join the battle and learn more. Visit cycleforsurvival.org. We're back with Dr. Jeremy Richman. He, along with his wife Jennifer Hensel, found the Aviel Foundation to honor the memory of their daughter Aviel, who was lost in the tragic Sandy Hook shootings on 12/14/12. Jeremy, the other component that we touched upon before the break for the Aviel Foundation is the initiatives that are community-based and various programs that you're either currently ramping up support of or hope to support and establish, not only here in Connecticut, but across the country, right?
That's right. Yeah, we're really excited to bring the educational side of the Aviel Foundation out to different communities, and we really want to start here in Newtown. But we've had a lot of opportunities to travel around and try to bring communities together. For the most part, our community engagement has started with a lecture series that we've been able to give to a couple thousand high school student level audiences, mm-hmm. and then at least 2,000 or 3,000 adult audiences that really span the range from first responders and law enforcement to Rotary clubs, to continuing education, retired adults, to scientific populations. And we also gave a congressional education briefing to the Senate and the House of Representatives in D.C. Hmm. So this is a educational seminar series on the science behind violence and compassion. And I think it's just to shed light into to break down onto an understandable level, what do we already know about the science of aggressive and violent behavior and how to prevent it and build compassion and empathy in communities? And then also to highlight the unmet need for more research and support in that area and how to intensely give some incentive to students to move into that field, mm-hmm. of neuroscience and behavioral pharmacology and psychology. That over the last year was our primary community engagement project, was really to develop a seminar and to find a lot of audiences to provide it to.
Well, drilling into the subject matter of that, if there were one or two key things that everyone listening this morning or who listened to the podcast online could take away right now based on what you already either think strongly based on evidence or know due to proven outcomes, what's the critical point people need to realize about aggression and violence? Whether it's in their family, in their school community, in their neighborhood, or in their city or town at large?
Yeah, that's a great question, and it's a tough one to answer. But for the most part, I really think that people need to understand that the brain isn't a mystical, magical organ, that it is just like our other organs, and it can be healthy and unhealthy, and that it's shaped both genetically and through our environment, almost equally, and meaning that, you know, when they say there's a nature-nurture debate, there's really no debate. We know that the way that we perceive and interact in our environment is shaped by our genetics that we're born with. But the environment shapes what genes are turned on and what organs, when and for how long. Mm. So you really can't separate them. So you're not resigned to a particular life or behavior because, you know, you were born into a family of somebody that was, say, violent. And you're also not free to rest on your laurels if you weren't. Mm. That you have to raise your kids and take care of yourself in a way that's responsible. And that there's a lot of environmental factors that we have a lot of control over that influence our behaviors. Exposure to childhood adversity has a profoundly negative impact on our behaviors as we grow up. And so we have to keep our family members and our peers healthy and safe. Our nutrition really matters, and the media that we're exposed to really matters. And probably the last thing is that we have a lot of control over is protecting the physical damage to the skull. So, you know, when our kids are encouraged to play sports, and they absolutely should be, it's one of the best things we can do for them. But we need to protect their heads and recognize when there's been damage, maybe a concussion, and make sure that they heal so that that damage doesn't culminate into behavioral problems later on.
Very good. So I guess at this point, with a few minutes left to spend with you this morning, Dr. Richmond, let's talk about the team that is the Aviel Foundation. You already talked about the critical role that your wife, Jennifer Hensel, is playing in every facet of the development of your family as well as the foundation. Who are some of the other folks who are key players in the Aviel Foundation today? And just a quick little word or two about the role that they are playing.
Well, we have a really outstanding. We were blown away by how much support we had in the scientific community, and we were able to put together a really world top class science advisory board that's comprised of some of the top neuroscientists in the world, including the head of psychiatry at Yale, John Crystal, a neuroscientist who manages one of the longest running longitudinal studies at Duke and King's College in London. Her name is Terry Moffitt. We have one of the top researchers at the National Institute of Mental Health, James Blair. And then we have two behavioral biochemists that have studied violent and aggressive behavior, particularly with psychopaths, in Adrienne Rain at University of Pennsylvania, and the head of the Mind Health Initiative, and the professor at the University of New Mexico, Kent Keel. These are real luminary scientists that are making breakthroughs in understanding aggressive behaviors and how to prevent them. On the other side of things, we have just the everyday people in our community and communities across our country that help us to engage, to find ways to engage communities and to educate them. And these include teachers, doctors, lawyers, different forms of coaching and mentoring. We've got a great partnership with Franklin Covey to teach leadership and empowerment skills. So we've got a lot of support with the foundation right now, and we're trying to find the best ways to bring this to communities in educational ways.
Very good. If anyone out there is listening and they'd like to get in touch and learn more, perhaps get a representative from the Aviel Foundation to come to them and give a talk or a symposium, a lecture, perhaps appear on a panel, wherever you may be listening, all you need to do is go to avielfoundation.org, A-V-I-E-L-L-E, foundation.org. The Aviel Foundation was founded shortly after the Sandy Hook tragedy in memory of Aviel Richmond, one of the 20 children lost on 12/14/12, and it is doing great work, groundbreaking work, helping to try to prevent violence by fostering brain health research, education, and policy, as well as community development, engagement, and responsibility. Jeremy, on this second anniversary, we wish you and your family the best. It's so great to hear the voice of Imogen, your infant daughter, on the line, and it was great to provide an avenue for her to make her radio debut this morning here on the award-winning For the People. So thanks for joining us, and I look forward to talking to you and making you a regular resource on the program so we can help teach the world about the groundbreaking work that you're doing in brain science, all to honor Aviel. Thank you so much.
Thank you, John. I appreciate it.
So as we mentioned in the introduction of the program this morning, we're welcomed into the home of Nelba and Jimmy Green here in Sandy Hook, and we're here to talk about the Anna Grace Project, which is the Greens' initiative that emerged from this horrible tragedy that we experienced here in Sandy Hook. And in
2015, we are celebrating a fantastic event that they're going to be bringing into Western Connecticut State University's brand new and incredible Visual and Performing Arts Center. That's coming up on December 3rd. It's called the 2015 Love Wins Mental Health Conference, and we'll be talking about that in just a few minutes with Jimmy. But first, I'd like to go to Nelva Marquez Green to talk a little bit about how the Anna Grace Project took hold and is now really getting a lot of regional and national attention for the work you're doing. So, Nelva, thanks for having us here today. And give us a little bit of insight into how this kind of ramped up and really kind of started taking hold.
For sure. Thanks for giving us your time, John. So I should give a little background and say that I am a licensed marriage and family therapist, and I've done that for quite a bit of time. So around the time of the Sandy Hook tragedy, that's what I was doing. I was functioning as a licensed marriage and family therapist and a part-time supervisor of master's level interns at Central Connecticut State University. I was also coordinating a psychiatric outpatient clinic for young adults and their families. So mental health has been a passion of mine for quite a bit of time. Immediately after the tragedy, and my husband and I both knew this was going to happen, we got into two major discussions. One was around gun control and responsibility, and the other was around mental health. But we were talking about mental illness. We weren't talking about anything on the prevention side. And even though my husband and I both took initiative in those spaces and took up some space in discussing these things that were really important and I still do believe needed to be talked about, we were missing one thing, and I really felt like we failed as a country to talk about the lands of family and maybe how they got where they were at the time. And not a conversation about gun violence, not a conversation about major mental illness, but to talk about what those fundamental things are that can influence a family towards health or lack of it. A lot of work around prevention, community, and connection. And if you look at the lands of family, they are a perfect example of systems that fail them.
So a lot of this information has been circulated in the media, but the bottom line is that it appears from all of the reporting that's been done that there were warning signs just so almost just past infanthood for that child.
Exactly. And Connecticut, although we are getting better as a state, we really need to look at what the gaps are in our existing services. Are there places and spaces for parents who have children who, you know, may not be developing typically to go in and say, you know what, something is wrong and I need help? I know many, many parents, and I've heard from many of them who say, it is really, really hard to find people to call me back. It's really hard to find support. I struggle with a lot of stigma. I live in a community where if people found out, I'm afraid I'd be alienated. So this is really really important information to get out there because, as you said, there were many, many signs that could have saved not only Adam and Nancy's lives, but also the 26 people that were murdered on December 14th, 2012.
Broadening out the focus and incorporating some of the history and experiences that you had in your field of expertise prior to the tragedy in Sandy Hook, and taking into consideration that my last read on the statistics are well over half of the parents of children that may have autism spectrum concerns or other issues may in fact themselves have some semblance of an issue. Were you getting any kind of practical or anecdotal idea that a lot of the parents of children who are being stigmatized kind of went through their early lives without any type of support and perhaps under the same sort of onus, the bullying, the ostracizing?
Absolutely. And first of all, I want to be really clear that no report indicates that having a mental illness or a developmental issue like autism spectrum disorder will automatically predispose you to being violent. We know that the contrary is true. We know that most folks who have or suffer from a mental illness or a behavioral developmental disorder actually are victims of violence and not perpetrators of violence. But to get back to your question, absolutely, which is why connection and community are so important. We find that we are looking for the wrong things when it comes to predictors of violence. We are looking for, okay, you know, we know that this kid is making trouble in school. You know what? We found that kids who make trouble in school, at least people know who they are. It's really looking out and building a safety net for those students and families who might be isolated that might actually protect us a bit more from these violent incidents.
So how has the focus of the Anna Grace Project or the projects that you are taking on now and in the future, how has that sort of shifted to accommodate sort of this expanded or even maybe a renewed goal?
For sure. First of all, I do a lot of public speaking. I go nationally and internationally to talk to people about trauma and how trauma, in fact, it impacts everyone and can impact kids from all walks of life. A lot of times we start this narrative around, okay, we know which kids are needy, poor kids, you know, kids of color, kids whose parents are incarcerated. You know what? While that might be a population that needs extra care, so do kids in suburbs. So do kids who grow up in relative affluence, like many of our mass shooters, who are actually suffering from other things, because we know that material wealth doesn't take away the negative impact of relational poverty. And that's not my quote. That's actually the quote of Dr. Bruce Perry, who is our keynote for the December 3rd event. He's a really well-known neuropsychiatrist who talks a lot about trauma. What we are seeing, and this is what I talk to people about, is kids who are really just growing up without those important connections they need in order to make a difference in their lives. So they lack hope, they lack mentors, and they can also lack those healthy developmental building blocks in order to make good choices later, especially when they face stress. So we're seeing an influx, or we're seeing an increase in a generation of kids who have all kinds of things, material things, and lots of access to the internet and screen time, but a decrease in relational connections. And we don't have any idea right now the ramifications for that on our bodies and our brains.
And on top of that, I guess it's sad to say that no matter how many incredible toys you have or how big the house or how rich your family might be, kids are kids. And when you get down into that peer group interaction, if an individual has a social issue or is on the autism spectrum and is exhibiting some of the behavior associated with that, they're still going to be subject to that stigmatizing.
Absolutely. And I try to tell people when I go out talking that all children hurt the same. So if you're living in a mansion or in the projects and you go to school and school is painful because you don't fit in for whatever reason, maybe you're not that sports kid, or maybe you're not super distinguished in your academics or in your music, kids hurt the same, and that will impact them. So one way I talk about this is through public speaking and training of trauma. And then we have two initiatives. One is a professional development initiative, like we bring in speakers and we educate folks on trauma and other issues. And the other is in the classroom. We go around to classroom and train teachers on different things they can do that are practical, inexpensive, and not time-consuming in order for them to build classrooms that focus on social and emotional learning. And even little things they do, taking time in the morning to do a 10-minute check-in, ensuring that children know that there is a plan in the playground in case someone's being bullied, in case someone's being left out of a game, and a plan for parental engagement. I can't tell you how important the family piece is. You can connect to a child all you want, but if you don't connect to the family, then that's going to be difficult to continue. So we really, really want to make sure we talk to schools and communities about the importance of engaging whole families for children.
If you're hearing something that resonates with you, your family, or maybe someone you know, friend, neighbor, coworker, you can visit anagraceproject.org, anagraceproject.org for that more information on the work that's being done by Nelva and Jimmy Green, who are welcoming us today for the program. We'll give Nelva a little bit of a break and shift gears to talk about scholarship initiative, as well as this event that's coming into Western Connecticut State University on December 3rd. As I move to my right, it's great to welcome Jimmy Green to the show, a renowned musician as well as a music educator at Western Connecticut State University and at other universities prior to his arrival here in Connecticut. Jimmy, thanks for having me at the house this morning.
My pleasure. Thanks for sitting down with us.
So let's start with the scholarship project, and we'll wrap up inviting folks out to this great event. Tell me a little bit about some of your hopes for educating and assisting aspiring musicians of the next generation.
Well, music is it's an amazing vocation. It's an amazing way to spend your days and nights thinking of music and writing and performing it. And it's also a community. It's a communal expression. And when I was a youngster, I had the benefit of having some amazing musicians to mentor me and to kind of bring me into this world. Chief among them, obviously, was Jackie McLean, who was one of the great saxophonists to ever play. And he was so giving of his time and his talent to not only me, but to so many aspiring musicians, that he really taught me, and others too. All the great musicians I've come in contact with over the years have always been so willing to give of themselves for the betterment of this art form that we love so much, mm-hmm. because we all realize that's the only way it can keep going and progress, and is by sharing, you know. So I really feel passionately about education. I feel passionately about sharing music with youngsters. And in the exchange, I learn a lot too. It's never a one, the flow of information never goes from one direction. It always comes back. Yeah. So in that way, you know, the music that we love and play and develop continues to grow and progress in all of us. It's pretty special, sharing music. And I often tell students, and it was told to me when I was a student, that when you're on the bandstand, when you're performing with anybody, no matter if they're a master and you just started, you're equals, you know? Mm-hmm. You're all just trying to listen and to do your best to serve the music that's being made at the moment. And that's a really beautiful thing, mm-hmm. that in the heat of the moment, there's really no hierarchy. There's only music.
Yeah. So what's the logistics of the scholarship plans?
Well, in the days after Anna was killed, I got several phone calls, emails, asking if there was some place to send money in lieu of flowers. Mm. And I had never, my mind was not there. I was in shock. I was just trying to function. But I thought a little bit about it, and Anna was a lot of things. A very gifted and talented musician was one of many things that she was. She loved to sing, and she sang very well, and she loved to be around music, and she always had music in her. She always had a song in her head. She was always humming or singing something. She loved to dance, too. Very talented in the arts. So Nelva and I felt that a great way to honor her life would be to somehow pay it forward to other youngsters who were pursuing their dreams in the arts. And what a better place to start than right here at Western, where I was at that time in my first semester of teaching. After returning to Connecticut from living in Winnipeg, Manitoba, teaching at a university there for 3 years. Mm-hmm. the dean of the School of Visual and Performing Arts at the time, Dan Goebel, I made a call to him in those early days, and he took care of everything else, basically. Between him and the Office of Institutional Advancement, they set up the scholarship fund, and people have been very, very generous in donating to it. And we've been able to offer five different young people a four-year renewable scholarship, a partial scholarship, to attend Western Connecticut State University to study music.
Excellent. And Western Connecticut State University is also going to be the host and the home of the 2015 Love Wins Mental Health Conference. It's coming up on December 3rd in this incredible new Visual and Performing Arts Center on the Westside campus. Tell us a little bit about that. And I know you have to be really excited and inspired that Dr. Bruce Perry is coming in to be your keynote.
Absolutely. Bruce is a wonderful person, and I'm not in the mental health field, but you know a good person when you meet one, and he's very warm and generous and giving of his time, and not only for his community, for the mental health community, but for everyone, for anyone who has been affected by trauma. He is an amazing resource and a wonderful human being to know. That being said, we're honored to have him, and to have him at WestCon is great. The new Visual Performing Arts Center is a beautiful facility, and the concert hall, which I get to step into, you know, almost on a daily basis, is just a magical, wonderful space. Mm. So it'll be nice to have those things converge, Bruce and this amazing mental health community that my wife has cultivated, and the place where I spend a lot of time these days.
So who is the ideal audience member, or who are among the groups that might be able to get the most benefit and pay the most forward post-conference?
That would probably be a question for Nelbo. Sure.
So we did this in 2013, and the audience were members from the government, members from the foster care community, members from the mental health community, from every discipline, social workers, marriage and family therapists, licensed professional counselors, psychologists and psychiatrists, folks who work in hospitals, folks who work in jails, folks, anyone who works with children and or families or rights policy or programming that affects and impacts children and families. The chief medical, anyone from the chief medical examiner to the folks who are on the ground doing direct service. Teachers. We had maybe, I think there were 18 different districts represented. This year, one district alone has purchased 68 seats for its administrators. So not only do we have Bruce, but our breakout sessions this year, we are able to ask national presenters. So we are covering topics such as school safety from Columbine to Sandy Hook, traumatic loss and bereavement, building up communities after tragedy, the healthy development of men and boys, and beyond talk therapy. What else can we do beyond talk therapy? There's so many different therapies that can be used with children and families. And oftentimes we just think of therapy as, you know, sitting in this chair and having someone, you know, talk psychobabble at us. And there's so much more to it than that. So we have the structure of the day is in the beginning, Bruce does a keynote. And in the after we have lunch together as a community. And then in the afternoon, you get to cycle through two breakout sessions. So you get to pick two sessions that work for you. And then we get back together as a community and have an end of day celebration. So it's a full day conference. You can find out more on the website. And there is still time to register, although I know at last count, we had very limited spaces. And I know what usually happens, John. People call me like 2 or 3 or 4 days before and say, can I still get in?
Schedule's free up.
Yeah, Western is really strict with their fire code. So I know we are strictly limited to 350. Sure. And we are getting very close, even a month out. So we're excited.
And so this bodes well for the next conference, putting a circuit breaker in to allow you to move into the O'Neill Center.
Yeah.
or perhaps into the stadium if this gets popular.
If it gets bigger, yeah. I can't tell you enough how amazing Western Connecticut State University and the community in Newtown, the collaborative group of folks working together, giving us a grant to scholarship folks most affected by Newtown, and Klingberg Family Centers, who I used to work for and then could not go back to my regular job running the outpatient clinic. They're handling registration. They are sending volunteers. This is really a labor of love. There's no way. I mean, Jimmy and I are here, and we will be here as Anna's mom and dad forever and ever. But there is no way you get up in the morning and do this without a team. And we are just so thankful for our team that helps us do this.
Well, I'm thankful for you helping us be able to tell the whole state of Connecticut all the great things that you're doing, and how this conference undoubtedly will domino into another and another, and perhaps get bigger, and perhaps even move outside of Connecticut and into other states and
communities. So many people have asked. They've said, can you come? Can you do? Oh, my gosh, I heard about your conference. Can you come to another state? And we just want to grow well. But grow slowly and well. We want to do this the right way. I'd love to, but at the end of the day, we're two parents trying to pull this together. So yes, if the infrastructure was there and we're working towards building that, we would love to take this show on the road.
Yeah. Well, I thank you two very special thank parents you. For having us do the program here today. Folks, once again, if by the time this airs, there are still seats available, it is the 2015 Love Wins Mental Health Conference, December 3rd at Western Connecticut State University. If by some chance it is already sold out, I'm sure many of the resources that are being passed on will eventually show up on the website, anagraceproject.org, ANAGRACE project.org is the website to go to learn about this, as well as all of the initiatives that are being headed up by Nelba and Jimmy Green. And we thank you guys for having us in today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host and do not necessarily represent the views of Connoisseur Media. If you have a suggestion for a guest, an issue, or a community calendar item relevant to the audiences and communities we serve, you must make your request for consideration in writing via email to me at john.voquette@connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast. Our public file reflecting the full scope of our station's responsiveness to critical issues in the communities we serve can be viewed upon request weekdays during normal business hours at 869 Blue Hills Avenue in Bloomfield. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott's, with original music by Noel Vayette. I'm John Voquette, Director of Public Affairs for Connoisseur Media. Join us again at this time next week for another installment of the award-winning For the People. Or listen to this and other For the People podcasts under the podcast tab at our radio station website or on iTunes. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.
Hi, everybody. It's Andy and James here from your next favorite podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
That's right. We do fun facts.
Yes, we do. James, give me a fact.
Did you know that there is an extinct bandicoot whose official scientific name is Crash Bandicoot?
Lovely. I didn't know that. Did you know, James, that Upper Egypt is technically below Lower Egypt?
Incredible. Absolutely amazing. I would love to hear more about that.
Well, all you have to do is go and listen to No Such Thing as a Fish.
Where will I find it?
Oh, all over.
Okay, bye.
Bye.